Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we have a story for you that comes out of the Pacific War in World War II. In November of 1944, a team of Army airmen set out on what should have been an easy mission off the coast of Borneo. And instead, they were shot down by the Japanese, and they found themselves stranded in the jungle, injured with no food or shelter, and none of them would have survived without the help of the indigenous people who risked their own lives to help these American soldiers. The story is told in a recently published book. The title of the book is The Airmen and the Headhunters. The subtitle is A True Story of Lost Soldiers, Heroic Tribesmen, and the Unlikeliest Rescue of World War II. Harcourt is the publisher. And the author is Judith Hyman. She's a career diplomat and author. She spent 7 years living in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, including 2 years in Borneo, where she learned to speak Malay Indonesian. She spent a lot of time traveling to talk with people involved in this story. In fact, all of the survivors she spoke with on in the course of doing the research for the book. And Ms. Lowe.
Hello, I'm Judith.
Oh,
How do you do?
All right, Judith. Well, we appreciate your giving us some of your time. It's a great, great story. And I think that it's just, you know, it's one of those stories that gets, as I said maybe a couple of minutes ago in introducing it, one of those stories that maybe gets lost somehow in the larger story of the war. But it's just a fascinating, fascinating story. And truly, the thing that you keep coming back to again and again is, had it not been for the indigenous people, these American flyers, they just wouldn't have made it.
Well, that is certainly the story that I got from the airmen themselves, and they were very clear about it. One of them, actually the only one still living now, Dan Illerich, was when he was rescued, he spoke to his Presbyterian church group in Sacramento, which had sponsored the Boy Scout activities that he'd taken part in as a child, and they wanted to know if his training as an Eagle Scout had helped. And he said he hadn't known what to do, that they hadn't known how to find food, and they didn't know really how to manage themselves in the jungle. And finally, he said that if it hadn't been for the Dayaks, which were the local people, we would not have survived. He said, I think they were disappointed to hear that, but it's true.
Well, this concerns the crew of a plane, an Army B-24 bomber. It's a crew of 10 men. And this story all begins on November 16th of 1944. What was happening in the war in the Pacific at this point?
Well, the Battle of Leyte Gulf had happened the previous month, and that, they even knew at the time, was probably the turning point in the war, because they had managed, the Allies had managed to destroy so much of the Japanese Pacific Fleet that they were not going to have the carrier capability to fly planes off of, and they were even going to have trouble defending the homeland. And the Japanese had been so successful earlier in the war that they had places all over the Pacific, and they were really too thinly spread out to be able to protect those places. And so what they did was behave very harshly in order to scare the people to death, and they were pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. So it was a time where it was pretty likely that the Japanese were going to lose, but it was also pretty likely that an awful lot of people were going to die horrible deaths before that happened.
Yeah. So they were given this mission, the crew, to fly to attack a Japanese ship, or possibly two. They weren't really quite sure what it was that they would find when they got there, but they certainly were not expecting to fly into any heavy concentration of Japanese ships.
That's right, because the what was left after the Battle of Leyte Gulf had gone to hide in the comparative safety of Brunei Bay, which is off the northwest coast of Borneo, about due southeast from Vietnam. And when they got there, there were just more ships and more firepower against them than they could have believed possible. Three of the planes were shot, and their plane was really falling to pieces as they headed as far away from the coast as they could. The coast was where the Japanese were most prominent because 40% of Japanese oil was coming from Borneo at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Japanese were where the oil fields were. So they wanted to get as far away from there as they could, and they ended up in an area that had never even been mapped properly, hasn't been mapped properly yet, in north-central Borneo.
So this was this particular mission, they did not expect this to be particularly dangerous and didn't somehow expect to be confronted with what was left of the Japanese fleet after this serious defeat that they experienced. But certainly these men prior to this had indeed flown dangerous missions, and this kind of job, the job that they had, certainly was a dangerous job.
Yes. And they were so young. They were mostly under 20 years old. And in spite of being so young, they were really so good at their jobs. I mean, the co-pilot who had lost an ear from one of the naval shells was still holding on to his controls and managing to keep the plane going, even though parts of what should make it fly had been shot up, and his pilot was dying on the floor next to him. I mean, these were really not only brave, but immensely competent young men.
Mm-hmm. So the plane, they managed to hold it together well enough so that most of the crew could bail out.
Yes.
I believe that the pilot, the co-pilot, and the navigator, the three of them, were all killed.
Yes. Well, the co-pilot held on long enough to be able to say, "This is it, I'm going, hit the silk."
Mm-hmm. So then seven of the guys, including the nose gunner who was wounded, managed to jump out of the plane, land in the jungle, although they were all split up. They didn't all, as you might imagine, they didn't all come down in the same place. They came down in various groups and in different places.
Well, they came down in ones and twos, basically. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the canopy of the jungle of north-central Borneo, it looks like nothing so much as a whole crop of broccoli. I mean, it's just there doesn't seem to be anything human there, but they did find some smoke rising, and that alerted them that there were people around somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, it took them quite some time to get together, and it was all sharp mountains too. So even if you were a couple of miles away from somebody, that doesn't mean it was going to be easy to get to them.
Yeah. Our guest, let me just reintroduce, is Judith Hyman, and her book is The Airmen and the Headhunters. It tells the story here that we've just started out on. The subtitle is A True Story of Lost Soldiers, Heroic Tribesmen, and the Unlikeliest Rescue of World War II. It's published by Harcourt, and indeed it is a story that comes out of the Pacific War, World War II. Questions, so welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you start out talking about the experiences of two of these guys. One guy got down and was afraid that he might actually be alone, then bumped into another of his fellow soldiers, and they were really happy to see each other, so at least there were two of them. They found the wreckage of the plane. They got out what kind of survival equipment there was that had been provided for them, including an inflatable life rafts, which I guess in some circumstances would be useful. It sounds like they really, though, didn't provide them with very much, that is, the Army really didn't provide them with very much that would be useful, and certainly they weren't trained in jungle survival.
Yeah, their confidence level really, really plummeted on landing. I'm holding in my hands now the little similar from the same edition of jungle survival books. It's actually Jungle, Desert, Arctic, and Ocean.
all in one book.
all in one book. And the book, if you cut it in half, it's just the right size to make playing cards, which was, in fact, its only real use. And it's less than an inch thick, and it's full of useful advice like good food and good water are fairly plentiful in the jungle if you know where to look for them. And then it goes on about the coconut palm, which is a great thing. It just happened it wasn't growing where they were. And then other little bits of advice, like if you run into some natives, string tricks, the cat's cradles and spider webs that you did when you were a kid are an almost universal pastime with jungle natives all over the world. Mm. And then telling them, eat native food only when it has been well and freshly cooked, and be sure all water offered you by natives has been boiled. Under no conditions sleep in or near native camps or bathe in nearby streams. Avoid close contact with any native. Don't go around barefoot. Well, of course, they soon learned
to break
all of those rules.
They broke every single rule in the book, and probably that if they had not broken all those rules, they probably wouldn't have survived.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, the two men, they found each other. They got equipment, what they could, and they figured, well, we can't stay here, so they started walking until they met the Dayaks, some of the people who lived there.
Right.
And what was that experience like when these American flyers now first set eyes on the local folks?
Well, they had been told to follow a river and to keep on going downriver until they hit the coast. Well, if they had hit the coast, they would have hit the Japanese. And as a matter of fact, some later airmen did head that way and did hit the Japanese and did not survive. But anyway, they were still fairly high upriver, and they were sitting trying to figure out what to do. And then they saw across the river, and they later realized it was because the people across the river were willing to be seen, men in loincloths coming out of the brush toward them, bearing machetes and blowpipes with spears on the end of them. And then what happened was really what made the difference between whether they were going to survive or not. And they had enough sense to throw down their weapons and put out their hands, and the tribesmen walked across, waded across, and stuck their blowpipes in the mud and approached them with their empty hands to shake, and that was the beginning of their being saved.
And certainly the Dayaks, when they saw the Americans, one thing they knew they weren't Japanese. But they really, other than that though, they really didn't know who these guys were or where they had come from.
Well, in fact, one of them did, because there had been American missionaries there before. And though this man couldn't read, he recognized from having known this American missionary the letters U.S., not as letters, but as a symbol that he understood meant American. And he saw that on one of the holsters lying on the ground and shouted, "Yusa, Yusa, Yusa," to the others, and then they rounded them up and took them off to their longhouse. Now, a longhouse is a whole village in one great room, and in this particular tribe, there aren't even any interior walls. They're just different hearths spotted around for the different families, and as the airmen looked up at the roof, admiring how well this was made without any nails, they also noticed there were human skulls dangling from the rafters.
So here these two guys were taken in by the local people, and they were very nice to them. They treated them well. They gave them food. They took them home. So those all things bode well, at least as far as it went. But it must indeed, particularly because, as we've said, the advice they had was don't don't make nice with the natives, don't eat the food that they give you. So they were already, don't go with them to their houses. You know, they'd already broken all the rules. They must have had extremely mixed feelings about the situation that they were in.
Well, they also, I mean, they knew, this was back before television, it was back in the early days of color film. If you read the National Geographic, you might know a little about people like that, but not much. And all they knew about these were that these folks were savages and that they had been and maybe still were headhunters. And when they saw these skulls dangling, it seemed clear that they had been, if they weren't still, headhunters. So that was worrying.
And I guess maybe we should make the point, in spite of the title, that in fact at this point the Dyaks were not headhunters anymore.
No, but they had been quite recently, up until the mid-1930s. And though about half of them in this area had now become Christian, thanks to these American and Canadian missionaries, the other half were not. And their religion had a very important place for bringing the skull back from a rival head house and then venerating it and using it as a source of powers and fertility, and you fed it and you carried it around on a pole in triumph and all of that sort of thing. And it was kind of, if I can be really sacrilegious, it was sort of like having a Christian mass without the bread and the wine. I mean, there was a gap there, and who knew what was going to fill it?
Mm-hmm. Let me just again introduce our guest, Judith Hyman. She's author of the book, The Airmen and the Headhunters. It tells the story that in much greater detail. It's just a story that we're talking about here this morning about this group of airmen. This was a crew of a B-24 who were shot down and found themselves in the jungle of Borneo, and how, in fact, they were rescued and taken care of, hidden from the Japanese by the local people. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, so the people, these Dyak people, they took in the flyers, and no doubt they realized that this was something that they should be concerned about, weren't exactly sure what to do, and so they sent some of their fellows to the man who was the nearest local government representative to let him know, at least, that they had these American flyers.
Yes, and this was the man who they knew had the most knowledge of the outside world and who could advise them, and whom they had come to trust because he had started out as a missionary teacher, and then had been, as the Dutch were leaving, made a district officer. And then when the Dutch were pushed out by the Japanese kept him on as district officer. And so he sort of knew his way around, and they went to him to ask, "We've got these folks here. What should we do about them?" Mm. And Makahanap was the name of this man. He was also an Indonesian, but not from Borneo. He was from a Christian-educated milieu in a nearby island. And he was, because he'd been Christian-educated, pro-Western, but he also a very clever man and very cautious. And he knew that if the Japanese got word that any of his people were hiding them, that the Japanese would behave really very, very fiercely against those who helped. Mm. And in areas where I was telling you earlier about the airmen who went north and got into Japanese areas, all of the houses, all of the villages that had helped those airmen on their route were tortured and killed. So, I mean, this was a really serious problem, and Makahanap had to figure out what was going to be the safest thing for his district. At the same time, he really was rooting for the airmen. So he spent days consulting with the heads of the longhouses and just bringing the problem and the questions to their attention and sitting there with them while they all discussed it. And then when the headman had one of their number ask him, who will win this war, he had a question for them. What if the Yanks win and we haven't helped them? Mm. Well, I'm a retired diplomat, and I have to say I find his patience and his skill in this situation just take my breath away.
And he would certainly, because the island was occupied by the Japanese, he ultimately would have to answer to them. He would indeed be in a very difficult position because he certainly wouldn't want to do anything to endanger his own people. On the other hand, he did, in fact, feel a kind of a tie or feel drawn to the United States and to the Americans, and certainly wouldn't also want to see them turned over to the Japanese because he would know well what it was that would happen to them if that happened.
Absolutely. The Japanese were not taking prisoner of any airmen at that point.
So what to this point for the people of Borneo, what had been the experience of the Japanese occupation? I mean, would they have had a strong reason to feel one way or another about the Japanese?
Well, the only strong reason that affected the people of the interior, and this was the far interior, was that the Japanese had in 1942 come up and taken the foreign missionaries and taken them off and put them in a camp and then killed them all into separate. First they killed the men, and then a couple of months later they came back and killed the women and the children. But then they went away again, and they hadn't been back, you know, in more than 2 years, and they were on the coast, and the Dayaks, the local people, could feel with some justice that if they just didn't get into any trouble with the Japanese, they would be left alone. So they had really very little to gain in risking their lives for these airmen, and a lot to lose.
And did they have the sense, now this is the events here we're talking about, these take place in late 44 and early 45, so this was in fact near the end of the Pacific War, although it could be that the people that we're talking about here didn't know that. Certainly the airmen, they were cut off for a lot of this time, cut off from the outside world, so they didn't know what was going on.
You have no idea. I don't think anybody living today has an idea how far cut off they are. There were no transistor radios. There was absolutely no communication with the outside world at that time. And so they really didn't know. There were some Japanese traders who managed to get word by messengers back and forth, and they were telling Makahana, the district officer, that the Allies were going to win and the Japanese were going to lose. But Makahana had stood and watched while the whole island of Borneo fell without any resistance to the Japanese. He wasn't at all sure that was the way things were going to turn out. But nonetheless, he and particularly his wife felt that was the right side, and if they could help it, that they should do so. Mm-hmm. But one problem that they had, which was kind of ironic, was that the evangelical Christians among the half of his people who were, had been taught that telling a lie, even for the best of reasons, would send them straight to hell when they died. So when it came to hiding the Americans, the district officer realized he couldn't ask them to hide the Americans if they were in any risk of running across any Japanese, because if a Japanese came and said, "Have you seen the airmen?" they'd have to say. So the district officer had to ask the people who weren't yet Christians, because they could lie if the Japanese or their spies asked them.
So William Makahana, he went into this playing this rather dangerous game, after having decided he would was not going to turn the Americans over to the Japanese. But he did have to, in fact, try to persuade the Japanese that he was doing that he was in fact doing something to try to find them. So
right.
On the one hand, he was hiding them and moving them around, and on the other hand, he was trying to tell the Japanese, "Well, we're looking for these guys, but you know, it's kind of tough. It's jungle and it's tough out there. So we'll see if we can find them." But he managed at least for 6 weeks to persuade the Japanese that he was in fact making a serious effort to find the Americans.
Yes, it was a very tricky game. He sent them a sort of a tongue-in-cheek letter saying, you know, well, there I hear that there are Americans in our district, and then we found them, and we've sent them to a longhouse. It was a pagan longhouse and a non-Christian longhouse, where we can keep an eye out on them until you can come. And all of that was true, and he could rely on the fact that it would take the Japanese who was downriver three times as long to get up to him as it took his messenger to get down, because the rivers are so strong there, the currents are so strong there. And he could use that in-between time to make arrangements so that the airmen would be warned that the Japanese were coming, and the local people could be warned how to hide them. It was a very tricky game.
And eventually the Japanese decided they really were indeed being strung along, and then decided to send soldiers to try to go after these Americans.
Yes. And the local people had a lovely time planting, a shoe boot here and a little piece of cloth there and stuff to convince them that they had climbed up a particular mountain where they hadn't been, and to hide them in other places where they really could hide their tracks.
So that eventually here there is indeed a dramatic turning point when the Dayaks, rather than just playing this kind of hide-and-seek with the Japanese, go to war against the Japanese. And in fact, this man, Mr. Mahakana, it literally himself decides to declare war on the Japanese. And in fact, he told them that. He informs them of that fact. He writes them a letter saying that. So this group of soldiers that had been sent to try to find the Americans were killed by the locals. And from that point on, they were fighting a guerrilla war against the Japanese occupiers. What made them, him particularly, because he, I think, was the man who made this happen, make this decision to go to armed resistance against the Japanese?
Well, the Japanese were getting very close to some of the airmen. And so he was going to have to get rid of those Japanese. And he arranged a stratagem that's as old as history. He got a very beautiful woman of one of the tribes, a woman named Binum, who was at that point was 5 feet 8 inches tall and very beautiful. I interviewed her in her old age. And he asked her to take off all her clothes, something the women of her tribe never did, not even in front of their husbands, and stand on a rock midway in the river and call to the Japanese. There were 3 Japanese who were there, and call to them to come out and dance with her. And meanwhile, her husband and a few others crept up behind to where the Japanese were staying and got their weapons and came up behind the Japanese and lopped their heads off. And so Makahana realized that there was no way that this was going to be able to be hidden from the Japanese headquarters that was a few days downriver. And so the best defense was an offense.
And for a long time, really until the sort of the next part in the story that I'm sure we'll talk about, when a group of Australian commandos arrived, the Americans weren't involved in fighting. They weren't fighting with the Japanese. Was there a particular reason, either that they weren't weren't healthy enough, or perhaps that the local people felt that that was just much too dangerous to actually have them directly involved in fighting against the Japanese?
Well, you know, they didn't know their way around a jungle. Hmm. They didn't know how to walk up these mountain trails fast enough. They didn't know how to see people in jungle. They weren't competent with a blowpipe or with a machete. They didn't speak languages that would help them to be able to tell friend from foe. I mean, these folks who had been so tremendously competent in their airplane, they were babes in the woods, literally, on land.
Well, tell us how it is you came on this story.
Well, I'd been writing a book about a man who figures in this book as the Mad Major, a British eccentric, even more eccentric than the British usually breed. And he had been my next-door neighbor, our next-door neighbor in Borneo. And 10 years after he died in a freak accident, I started writing a biography of him. And I was in Canberra, Australia, looking at an archive of his. He had organized an Australian commando attack into Borneo to raise a local army behind the lines against the Japanese. And among his letters in his archive, there was one that was written in, you know, the Palmer method penmanship that people were taught in the States in the 40s, that wonderful round, clear handwriting. Well, this letter just leapt out because it was so unlike the British and Australian writing. And it begins, April 3, 1945, "Dear Sir, we just received word that there are seven of you who've landed in Borneo for the purpose of organizing the natives in warfare against the Japanese. And there are seven of us from a U.S. Army B-24 shot down November 16th, and two from a Navy B-24 shot down January 13th, and we're staying with William Makahamup," and it goes on and so forth, and saying, "We need the help that warfare weapons can give these natives, and of course we Americans would like to see you, and we'd like to get out of here as soon as possible." And it's signed Philip Corrin, second lieutenant, who was the only surviving officer from that army plane, and eight other American airmen. And when I saw that letter, I thought, oh, gee, that's book number two.
Mm-hmm. So this was not something that you had the opportunity to talk with Tom Harrison about before he passed away?
I had talked, well, he was a boastful man. My book about him has the accurate title, "The Most Offending Soul Alive," and he talked about having parachuted into Borneo during World War II, but he hadn't really talked about the airmen, and so that was a real discovery for me. And then I started tracking down those people, and it was a hard job. By the time I succeeded in tracking down, a number of them were already dead. But I was able to interview five of them and get memoirs and tapes and stuff from a couple of others of them. And then in 2003, I was able to go to Borneo, and because I speak Indonesian, I was able to interview the surviving ex-headhunters.
Well, once again, I'd like to introduce the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Judith Hyman. She is a career diplomat and writer. She spent 7 years living in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, including 2 years in Borneo, where she learned to speak Malay Indonesian. And she's the author of these two books that we mentioned, that she just mentioned. The one is The Most Offending Soul Alive, which is about this man, Major Tom Harrison, and then another story in which he also plays a role, that's just the newly published book. The title is The Airmen and the Headhunters, A True Story of Lost Soldiers, Heroic Tribesmen, and the Unlikeliest Rescue of World War II. It's published by Harcourt and is indeed the story about these men, an army, a crew of army flyers who in November of 1944 were shot down. Their plane went down in the jungle of Borneo, and it's the story about how it is that they were saved and taken care of by the local people and certainly would not have survived if not for their help. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I guess the thing that's really one of the things that's striking about this story is that we talked about the fact that when the plane, they jumped, they knew they were going down. So the men that could, seven guys, got out of the plane, they parachuted out, and came down into the jungle in ones and twos. And so a couple of the guys ended up with one particular group of Dayaks, and some other people wound up with some others, and another guy lived with some other people. And what seems to be really impressive here is that the indigenous people were unfailingly gracious to their guests and consider them guests. They couldn't talk with them because nobody, there was no language in common that they could speak, but that they took care of these men. They fed them what they could. They brought them into their homes. If they could give them something to wear, they did. I mean, they did everything they could to take care of these people. And even though they must have had this idea that there was some danger for them in aiding these Americans.
Oh, there was great danger for them. At one point, the Japanese actually took hostage some of their children in a boarding school in order to get the head of the non-Christian Dayaks, so the ones who was most responsible for helping them to get him to be surrendered, and they heard the stories of what happened up north, where people who had protected another group of airmen who were heading north, what had happened to them. Now they knew very much about the danger, and they would only be able to put the airmen for a while in a hidden valley that the airmen called Polecat Gulch, and would come to them only at the times when they felt it was safest. So sometimes there would be as much as 5 days between meals, and the airmen lost a lot of weight. But as soon as they could safely do so, and even when it wasn't really safe, but they thought it might be, the Dayaks were very careful to bring them food and even bring them cigarettes and anything that they could to make life more comfortable for the airmen.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. And they're in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm a little late to the show, so I apologize if I ask questions, but isn't it a fact that toward the end of the war, the Japanese massacred all of the prisoners of war in Borneo, especially the Australians?
There was a group of British and Australian prisoners of war. They were in Sandakan, and the Japanese moved them to the center of what was then British North Borneo, is now the Malaysian state of Sabah, and walked them across Borneo from the east to Ranau, and by the time they got to Ranau, instead of being something like 1,500, they were down to about 26. All the rest had died en route. And then about a week or two after Hirohito signed the peace treaty, they murdered those.
Yeah, you know, I've heard arguments from people who were against dropping the atomic bomb, saying that, well, Japan was finished and there was no need to do this. In fact, they were planning to invade Japan with over 1 million men. And I believe I read somewhere that the Japanese had orders that the minute the invasion started, all of the prisoners were to be murdered.
Well, I believe, I mean, it seems, it tracks. When in Borneo, in the island of Tarakan, it took forever for the Australians to manage to conquer this tiny little island, because the Japanese simply wouldn't give up. And when, at the end, some of the Japanese were fleeing on rafts off the coast to certain death, the Allies were trying, the Australians were trying to rescue them, you know, take them prisoner but not kill them, the Japanese on the rafts were raking them with machine guns. I mean, they simply didn't know how to surrender. And I agree with you that if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb, which came across as something supernatural, they would never have surrendered.
No, they would have kept on fighting. The war might have lasted another year. Thousands of Americans would have been killed.
And many, many Japanese.
Yeah, it would have been a bloodbath.
Yeah. I think it really did save lives, not just of the Allies, but of Japanese.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're coming down to the point. We have about 6-7 minutes left. Maybe you just might talk for a moment or two about Tom Harrison and about what he did in Borneo in raising and organizing this local guerrilla army that fought the Japanese.
Well, he actually came, he already had the idea to do what by accident the airmen did, which is take advantage of the fact that they were guests in this country rather than occupiers, rather than bosses. And he had his Australian airmen go off in ones or twos, no more, to different places, and he didn't give them any food, and he denied that he had food. He did have food. But his feeling was that if the airmen, if his men, were not able to convince the local people to feed them, they were as good as dead anyway. They were really forced to behave like guests. And the fewer of them in a particular place, the more likely they would be to learn the language and to learn how to get on in the community and how to make the community like them and want to help them. And that certainly was true with the airmen who had landed before then. The most competent by the time he got back with the Americans was Tom Capon, who was on his own for months and as a result had learned the language. He'd learned how to hunt the way the Dayaks did. He'd learned how to stand still for hours, even if there were ants crawling all over him. And he was just better at it because he was on his own and he had no choice than to adapt to the local place. I think there's lessons there that Tom Harrison drew that became really the kernel of what is now a lot of thinking in guerrilla warfare generally, mm-hmm. that less is better than more, and behaving like a guest is better than behaving like an occupier.
So this is, I think, an interesting aspect of the story that I'm sure that when the Allies launched this plan to send Harrison and his Australian guerrillas into commandos into Borneo, that they didn't know that the Americans were there. So they had this. They had some ideas about how they were going to do this. But you wonder to what extent the fact that the Americans were there and that the local people had already decided to turn on the Japanese, how much of that had to do with the presence of the Americans? And if the Americans had not been shot down and had not landed in the jungle and had not gotten involved with the local people, what would the plan, would the Allied plan to organize this indigenous guerrilla army have gone as well as it did?
Well, it's a good question. I hadn't thought of it in that terms. There was another element in the enthusiasm that the inland tribes people felt for Harrison and his crowd, and that was, after the first night's discussion, the word went out that it was going to be all right to go back to headhunting as long as they were Japanese heads. And that was hugely popular because everybody in that part of Borneo had been headhunters.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see if we can get at least one more caller in here in the time that remains. Line one is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Regarding the atomic bomb, I read that Eisenhower stated he didn't think it was necessary to drop that thing on the people of Japan, and I would think he would be in a position to know, but his theater was Europe, and so he could have been wrong. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, it certainly, this is at this late date in the program and in this program, I don't know this we can come up with a solution to this issue. I guess we have to acknowledge that still to this point there is argument about the role of dropping the bomb, whether it was necessary and so forth.
Yeah, it's a difficult problem. It certainly was true that when Japanese prisoners were taken, they pled with the Allies not to send them back to Japan, to take them to the States or wherever else, because it was a crime worse than anything to be taken prisoner, and they would never live down the shame of it.
Mm-hmm. So we're coming down here at a point where we have a couple of minutes left, and I want to leave at least something here for people to get if they would like to read the book. But I suppose it would not come as a surprise to people listening that, indeed, eventually these airmen did get out of Borneo.
They got out. Tom Harrison arranged for a bamboo airstrip to be built in the middle of Borneo, and as soon as there was an airstrip within 200 miles of this airstrip in the middle of Borneo, they were able to fly Alsters, which is kind of like a Piper Cub, in, and flew out these airmen one at a time over 200 miles of enemy-held jungle, with no radio, no parachute, not enough fuel to get them more than one way, because the planes were short takeoff and landing and they had such limited fuel capacity. One airman at a time, they flew them out.
And despite that danger, I'm sure all these guys said, yeah, okay, we'll go. We're ready to go?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it was, they were thrilled to do it. And they've remained actually friends with the Australians who flew them out ever since.
So you did have the now when you were doing research for the book, you did have the opportunity to talk with some of these men, those men who at this point were still alive.
Oh yes. I spoke with five of the airmen. I spoke with a number of the Australians. I spoke with a dozen of the ex-headhunters, and with widows of all of the above. Mm-hmm.
Do you, and I wonder if you got the sense or you directly engaged them and got them to talk about the ways in which they felt their lives were changed, that somehow they ended up being different people because they had this experience?
Well, I think the Americans came out of it with a really an entirely different view of what life was like in other societies. I mean, for example, at one point they're going to a head ceremony, and they're shown where the aristocrats are going to eat. By the way, headhunters are never cannibals, and so they're looking at these beautiful place settings for the aristocrats in a raised area in the center of the longhouse, and then they're sent off to where they're to eat. And I asked one of them, well, didn't you feel offended that you weren't eating at the head table? And one of them said, no, of course not. After all, we weren't aristocrats.
Well, it's a very, very interesting story, and I really appreciate you taking some time and talking with us about it.
Well, it was a pleasure for me. Thank you so much for asking me.
And again, our guest is Judith Heimann. If you're going to look for the book, her last name spelled H-E-I-M-A-N-N. And the book is The Airmen and the Headhunters, a true story of lost soldiers, heroic tribesmen, and the unlikeliest rescue of World War II. And the book is published by Harcourt. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Provena Medical Group, where doctors treat people, not illness. More information available at 1-866-PROVENA. The physicians of Provena Medical Group encourage you to join them in supporting WILL. Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets at midday. A lot of red on the screen over at the grain pits. A little bit of green, though, for CME livestock. Let's jump right in with the numbers. May wheat in Kansas City now trading at 10.55, down 68. July, 10.29, down 65 and a half. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 10.05, down 69. July, 9.89, down 59. December, 10.09, down 55. May corn, 508 and a quarter, down 19. July, 519 and a half, down 19 and three quarters. September, 522 and a half, down 19. December, 521 and a quarter, down 20. May soybeans, 1207, down 50. July, 1222, down 50. August, 1218, down 48. November, 1140, down 50. May soybean meal, 308.30, down 240. July, 312, down 370. May soybean oil at 54.40, down $2. July, 55.14, down $2. April live cattle, 90.65, up 102.5. June, 90.95, up 100. March feeders, 99.10, down 25. April, 103.05, up 90. April lean hogs, 55.25, up 30. May, 66.20, down 65. Take a look at outside markets. May crude oil at 101.25 is down $1.29. June, 195, down 68 cents. The CRB is off 7.21, its tick at 381.09. The U.S. dollar trading firmer today. It's up 80 cents at 72.83. The Dow, 12,224, is up 124 points. Gold for the month of April at 921.